Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Greetings, slackers. How he's doing? He's good. Are you well? I've taken a massive break this season. I mean, like, you know, there's been seasons before where, like, you know, it's podcasts. You can take a little bit of a break. But as a lot of you who follow me on Instagram and Twitter will know that I just recently got a job on Sirius XM. I do their Drive Time alternative music show. And since starting that, slackers taking a back seat. And you know what? No more, my friends. I have 10 episodes done. The rest of the season is finished and will be coming out again weekly. So far this season, we've had Moby, we've had Bicep, we've had Royal Blood, we've had Kojak. And I want us to get back into the rest of these because I have some incredible names coming up. Graham Coxon. I don't want to give them all away. Thank you to everybody who is subscribing to the Slacker Podcast Patreon, which you can do at patreon.com/slacker. A podcast if you enjoy the content. Also, I'm starting a new thing which you can get to on my just search me out on Twitter. It's called FIFA and Feedback. So if you make music of any description and you want me to review it while I'm playing FIFA on Twitch, then please send it to me that way. All the details on that will be on my Twitter page, so just go and search all that out and you'll be able to find it from there. This week on the show we have Fleet Foxes. I'm a big fan. Like, I think their debut album when it came out was absolutely rinsed in my house, and it was just great to see them doing so well. I decided, right, let's get Robin from Fleet Foxes on the show for a little bit of a chat, come through a little bit of a demo, and we're going to just have a lovely time all together. We're going to have a wonderful time, everybody. It's time for our Slacker Podcast with Fleet Foxes in 3, 2, 1. Slacker Podcast with Robin from Fleet Foxes. How you doing? How's things? How you well?
I'm good, Phil. Thank you.
It's good to have you on. Good to have you coming fresh with a demo for us as well. But we'll get that in a bit. I love your microphone. I'm such like a geek for microphones. And like anytime I see somebody with a new one, I mean, I've got this like Rode bad boy here. Which seems pretty, yeah. Pretty. Yours looks like something out of the 70s.
Yeah, this is an old AKG C12B that I only got like a week ago. I needed a new mic, new vocal mic, so I've been trying it out. It sounds good.
Is it like when you get a new mic, do you have to like test it out? Do you have to like go in with like the real fucking Tina Turner style vocals on it?
I should. That's a great idea. Like go to the whoever's selling it and ask them to set it up and just wail.
You're simply the best. You're like, okay, yeah, it works. how's life? I mean, like we're all like, as we record this and for posterity's sake, the 17th of February, in the UK, it's boring as shit. Like, what about you?
I'm feeling bored, but it's a good board. I feel like last year was obviously very intense for everyone, and I'm kind of in, you know, right now in a normal situation, I'd be on tour right now, having put out a record 4 months ago. So to not have that be happening, this is a first for me in my adult life, and I'm just trying to make the most of it. Things are good. It's different. Like it's strange, but it's good.
Are you pining for like the tour of this record, or is this like a switch up that's quite nice for you?
The songs were written really with the intention of performing them live, and songs that would be fun to build a show around. So that it was kind of ironic that it came out and then that wasn't an option at all. And it'll be interesting. I mean, like, I don't know when we'll have the chance to rehearse it all, I guess next year or something. It'd be interesting to revisit it at that point, and who knows, you know, where everyone's heads will be at then. But I think it, for me, it's like the more time to think about what the show will be and to even work on new songs and all of that is like just the more time, the better. So
Do you feel that itch to keep creating and keep writing Fleet Foxes stuff? Like, because sometimes, you know, they always talk about, like, you know, you wait long enough for a bus to come, then two come along at once.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, for me, like, having this period where I'm not working on, I don't have an album to work on. I'm actually working on way more music than I would have expected, just as kind of a daily, like almost like not like therapy and like a working through something, but just kind of like you would, as if you would meditate or go for a run or something. I'm spending like a couple hours a day just making music for fun with no judgment, no expectation of what it's going to be. But I'm way more productive as a result of that than maybe I ever have been before. So that's been a cool new thing to realize as well. Like, and so there's definitely going to be more music. I can see how Taylor Swift was able to make like 10 albums in quarantine.
Yeah, isn't that the most badass story, like of her reclaiming the masters to her, well, I mean creating new masters, really? Like, I mean, that story's so badass.
It's amazing. Yeah, that's great. I mean, like, that is incredible. And it's going to be this whole, yeah, she gets to reclaim her masters and have this whole added promo campaign for years of re-releasing her albums, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you need to have the patience to be able to sit down and remake them, like, but yeah, I mean, there's not really a downside to it. Like, she can't buy them back. It makes me think about like Michael Jackson buying the Beatles back catalog, because I was watching a documentary recently, and Michael Jackson had done a collab with Paul McCartney, and he was like, I'm going to buy your masters one day. And, like, you know, I'm going to buy the Beatles catalog one day. And Paul's like, yeah, yeah, right, y'all. Whatever. And then turns around and buys it. Like, I mean, is that like a fear of a songwriter, of somebody else, like, you don't know, like, buying your catalog? Or, because, I mean, that's quite present right now with Dylan and Neil Young and stuff selling off their stuff.
I haven't had to. I mean, I don't think my catalog is valuable enough to have to worry about that. I mean, with Taylor Swift, well, I listened to that song she put out, the more recent, the newer recording of her old song. And the thing it made me think of was like the two recordings of Goldberg Variations, the Glenn Gould recordings, where it was cool to hear her record something at a more mature age and hear the change in her voice, even though the track remained kind of the same. And like, even creatively, it's an interesting thing.
It definitely is. I was shocked though, and because like there's these companies now that are like full of like billionaires and hedge fund people and stuff, and they're going around and they're buying up shop. And I was surprised like when Neil Young sold his stuff, because I was like, he's always been like the anti-establishment kind of guy, and I was wondering. When you get to a certain age, is it just like going, you know what, maybe it's good to have some money to pass down or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what the thought processes are behind those sales. Maybe something to do with like something as boring as capital gains tax, or like how to, you're thinking about your estate and how it's easier to divide up cash than it is to divide up rights, or
maybe Dylan just wants to be buried with it. He's just like, you know what, I want all of it, and I want the biggest damn gold coffin there is, and I want
for sure.
Listen, I didn't start this podcast thinking I'd be talking about the death of Bob Dylan, but listen, here, that's where we are. I thought it would be a good idea to play a demo, as we do at on the Slacker podcast all the time, at the beginning. Cool. And this is one, it's called The Idiot Keys. Let's hear a little bit of it and we'll come back after.
It's okay, you don't remember. I won't take it very personally. Sweet enough, but getting rough. Let the sixes laugh and stack it up. Pitch and roll and hit the floor. And you spill the water in your cup. Dust your knees and see the breeze. See it dance with the trees so happily. And smile, then stay a while, stay to dream and be free before you leave. I've got something else to show you. I just know you'd love it.
That was Robin Bagnall, The Idiot Keys. Although you didn't go under that name with that EP, did you?
No. Yeah, so that was from an EP I made when I was 16. And I thought the last name Pecknold was, honestly, still feel that it's a little awkward. I've kind of embraced it at this point. But I was going by Robin Voss, which was like, I thought I needed a fake last name, like Dylan or something.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Robin Noel Voss, actually, is it to give it its full title? When did you drop that? When was it like going?
I was saying no. That was like 2003. I was like, so I was 16 or 17. Mm.
You've got a very mature voice on that for the age. If you like, you would not put that down to a raspy voiced 16-year-old.
I know my voice sounds totally different. I think because I grew up being in like school plays, and I was into like, I think I was like listening to Rufus Wainwright around that time.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Strokes and Rufus Wainwright. And like, so somewhere between like Julian Casablancas and Rufus Wainwright, that kind of like theatrical, slightly deeper singing style. But it's quite embarrassing now for sure.
Are you like a vocal Benjamin Button, where you're like getting younger as you get older? Like, you're gonna sound like a child, like, yeah, when you're like 50 or 60.
That came up, this Benjamin Button thing came up a couple days ago too.
Oh, where, really? Okay. what were they saying?
I was in a different Zoom meeting about a different project, and the people I was talking to were like, we thought when, you know, Fleet Foxes came out in 2008, we thought it was just a bunch of like 50-year-old wizards. Like, oh, he's my age. They were surprised I was like 34 and that not some, yeah, some Gandalf out in the woods somewhere.
Have you had
some, yeah, aging in reverse?
Have you had to put up with much of that, like, throughout your career? Like, obviously, maybe more so at the start, of people expecting a different scene than that they're getting, because, like, you know, Young Whippersnappers in 2006, 2007, 2008, blasting out this very organic music of the soil. Like, do you know what I mean?
Have I had to kind of...
Have you had, like, a people... Because, I mean, I do shows on, like, on a very much smaller scale. Like, I do radio programs, and when people see me, they're like, you don't look like what I thought you look like.
Oh, right,
and I'm
for
like,
sure.
Well, I'm like, what did you think? And they're like a fat guy with a beard, and I'm like... I don't know. Do I take that as an insult or is it?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. No, I mean, I think like, definitely. I mean, I could talk about that for hours, but I think it was fun at the time in Seattle. Everyone was, you know, growing huge beards and growing their hair out and wearing flannel shirts. And we were just like having fun being in the Northwest doing that, but I was pretty young. I was 20 years old working on that first Sleep Foxes record. So there was a bit of a kind of like, I was trying to seem older than I was maybe, but I was also really ambitious and wanted to get a music career going.
What is the geographical positioning of like Kirkland to Seattle? Are they right beside each other?
Kirkland's just like 20 minutes east across. There's like Seattle. There's a lake on the east side of Seattle called Lake Washington. And then on to the west of Seattle is the Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. And so Kirkland is just on, when I grew up, is very sleepy, like low income, middle income area, 20 minutes east of Seattle, across a big bridge and suburban. Now it's pretty, I think like Google and Amazon, a lot of tech companies have set up campuses there. So it's like a much more expensive place to be. But when I was growing up, it was very sleepy. Mm. We're like, very sleepy.
So does that mean, suburban. Does that mean like it, when you wanted to sort of like get into like the music scene and get your feet dirty and sort of like go to gigs and stuff, that was just like, you're like, that's Seattle, that's not here.
Well, I mean, there was enough stuff on the east side of Seattle for teens. Like, there was a place called the Redmond Firehouse that was like you'd go see hardcore bands there or all ages shows or free shows. I mean, Seattle was a great place to be a teenager wanting to go to shows for sure. There was a Kirkland Teen Center that opened up that hosted shows every, you know, there were all these places to do open mics and coffee shops. And I would do those 3 or 4 times a week when I was a teenager. And then I would take the bus into Seattle to go to shows at the Vera Project or other all ages spaces, like around the university district. There was I was always on the 49 bus going to the U district.
Were you gigging back then? Like, were you playing shows as well as going to them?
Yeah. Yeah.
How good were you, like, or how bad or amazing or brilliant or shite were the first shows that you were doing?
Oh, it's horrible. I remember one time playing, the main thing was that I would go to these open mic nights. It's like where I lived, I could walk to this kind of like outdoor mall area that had like a movie theater and a coffee shop that did open mic nights and a Starbucks. And so I spent so much time down there sitting at the Starbucks, having like, ordering like a tea and having like philosophical conversations and like buying cigarettes with my fake ID and like playing open mics at the coffee shop. It was like the most quotidian environment, but it felt like I was in, you know, it was like an artist in Paris or something.
I'm doing it right.
I'm doing it. And I was loving like Bob Dylan, obviously. And I like learned a bunch of covers and play original songs at these open mics. And then I remember I was like, one time I did like the Tangled Up in Blue, but I did the alternate lyrics like from the New York version. So that, you know, that was the version I played. And then I was all proud of myself and then like took the guitar off, but I got my cape. I had like long hair and I got my capo stuck in my hair. So I had to walk off stage holding the guitar caught in my hair. That was very embarrassing.
Oh my God.
So I was playing a lot of shows like that just by myself and then started playing. I played in one band for a tour and then started playing band shows, Fleet Foxes shows once. I think it was like 19 or 20. Played a lot of shows where we had to just load in, play, and then leave because we were underage.
Yeah. I've experienced that like at South by Southwest I've been bringing over bands and stuff. It's, I mean, you're meant to leave, like, but do they? Sometimes, some places they're really militant. Like, you know, you could be like 21, like tomorrow, and they'll fucking march you out of there.
Totally. Yeah. You get the big X's on your hand and you play the show. And it's a little bit of a badge of honor. You know, you're like, I can just play the show and I got to go home.
Yeah. I'm like I'm Henry Rollins. I'm straight edge, man. when did the band start becoming a thing? Like, was it like a natural thing where you were like people were just adding to your solo stuff, or was it like more of a proper line in the sand?
I think like there was like the solo stuff, the singer-songwriter stuff, and then when I thought about starting a band, I thought about making it more like indie rock band music. There was like a EP of that kind of thing in 2006. Mm. And it didn't feel as good. And then I guess after that, we started integrating, I wanted to bring the songwritery acoustic stuff back into the thing, but do it as a band. And, so that was like kind of and then started listening to like Joanna Newsom and Grizzly Bear and Devendra Banhart and everything happening in like 2006. It was really inspiring and interesting, and stuff that was happening in Seattle, like the Cave Singers or Band of Horses, you know? So basically, we were like, what's that?
It was basically my playlist from then.
Yeah, totally. Me too.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, we were playing shows frequently and, you know, Seattle was a great place to be at that time, a great place to be a musician and the ecosystem was really clear, like what venue you would try and get your first show at on a Monday night and then what venue you'd try and get your next gig at, like opening for someone else, you know, just, it was just like the levels of the game.
Yeah.
Clear.
I mean, part of that levels is like, you know, you need to get to the end level body and then beat them and then get up to the next. I mean,
yeah, Jonathan Poneman at Sub Pop was the final boss.
That's what I'm saying. Like you got to the final screen. If this was like Donkey Kong or some shit, like you got to the final screen of Seattle music. And when you guys signed to Sub Pop, did it feel like that when you did? Like is Sub Pop as, I mean, of course it's as iconic in Seattle, but what was it like for you guys when that happened?
It was a little bit like you were describing. It was a little bit like speed running the Seattle music scene game.
Yeah.
exploiting glitches in the system. And it was special. Like how special to be in a city where, yeah, like, people from Sub Pop and shows every day of the week, you know, and if you're doing enough shows in Seattle, like you're on the right radar for sure. But you're on the radar of something that's like accessible, but it's like internationally significant, you know, and it is like legendary. which was I feel very lucky and grateful to have grown up in that environment, for sure.
But like, did you do the album with Sub Pop, or like, how did that work? Because like, I know like when you look at all of your stuff on Spotify, it says none such. Like, so.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So like, was it like, what did you do on Sub Pop?
Oh, well, for the first album, it was actually co-released. Yeah. For you guys, it came out on Belly and Simon Raymond's label.
Yeah.
Which great is an label. He's an amazing guy. Great label. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, I remember talking to him, and we kind of finished the album, and then we were shopping it to labels. Sub Pop was interested, and they wanted to do a worldwide deal. And I remember talking to Simon, and I was super young. I didn't know what I was doing, but he was like, and even, you know, he said it might serve you well. He said it might serve you well to do a deal with two labels for this record, one in Europe that's more central to Europe and can handle that, you know, more, has more boots on the ground there. And then one for a little bit of label in North America. Mm. So even though, yeah, so Sub Pop had it for North America and Australasia, and then Belly Union put it out in Europe and UK, everywhere else. And then we switched the digital rights to Nonesuch when we made, to do some reissues.
Okay.
A few years ago, yeah.
It always happens because I've run like an independent label for a while. I get like really bogged down in the minutia of
label
dates and stuff. Yeah, yeah. So am I. I always wonder, like, when you put together a band, like, how does it come together? Like, does it come together quite naturally? Do you like put an advert out, or is it people around the scene that you know? Like, how did Fleet Foxes become a band?
I think like the lineup was pretty fluid early on. It was a little bit of, so it was kind of me and my friend Sky, who plays guitar. We grew up together, but we didn't really know any other musicians in Kirkland, really. And then we went to Seattle and then started meeting people. And it was a situation where people were in numerous bands, and, you know, there were, you'd meet somebody who's a great bass player and they'd be in six bands and, yeah. And, you know, and you'd ask them, which totally made sense. And then I was also, you know, really kind of wanting to play with people older than us, you know, thinking that they had more experience and more talent. So I was used to working, being friends with older people and being, you know, the youngest of three kids, and just, I don't know. I was impatient, you know. It's like, so we got to get some old guys in the band to have, you know. So there were, you know, people like Christian Wargo. We loved his band Crystal Skulls, and you know, once there wasn't enough, it was kind of like friends of friends, and then meeting people, and then playing shows, and then having, you know, and then once there was enough kind of energy around Fleet Foxes, then it became like a main focus for people.
Mm. I mean, like, that's it. It's kind of testament to how you grow as a band that you can end about four other bands by people going, we're not going to be in that band anymore.
I know. That's a great point.
Is it weird, like, when your music starts being successful? Because you've spent probably more time than not being unsuccessful, not being unsuccessful, but being unknown, from putting out your own solo stuff to putting out maybe the first indie EP of Fleet Foxes. When what it is that you're looking for starts to arrive, does it arrive the way that you thought it would? Or, like, how do you deal with that? Because obviously you're still very young.
Yeah. You mean currently still young, 34?
No, you're still young. Yeah, I'm 34 too. I'm lying to myself saying I'm still young, but, like, listen.
We're young.
Yeah, we're, we are. We're not having existential crisis as you are.
We are the youths. Just the children are wrong.
Well, I found out the other day that I'm still technically a millennial, so I was like, I'm happy with that. Yeah. Like, end-level millennial, like, but still there. Yeah. When it comes along, like, what is it like?
Well, I didn't really, I don't know. When I look back on it, I'm like, yeah, I was, you know, I basically committed to this music thing at like age 15. You know, I felt like unstimulated at school. I loved, you know, I thought based on, you know, absorbing all these mythologies of, you know, the Beach Boys and the Beatles, you know, you got to be 19 or 20 when you're making your biggest impacts. You got to start now. And just, you know, I don't think in those terms anymore at all, but, you know, but by the time, you know, being 22 and playing Saturday Night Live when I was 22 was like, I just was not ready for that.
I
remember, like, we filmed a promo and like for that. And I just couldn't even be present in the promo. Like I sat down, everyone else was standing and like proud to be there. And like, I was like so uncomfortable. So I think that it was, I wanted to meet all those, like, meet the moment for sure. And I wanted to kind of, you know, enjoy the, like, what felt like really sudden acceptance of that record. But I was really uncomfortable also with a lot of it, or ill-equipped to handle it for sure.
Yeah, it is weird because, like, I mean, you equip yourself better throughout the years. And then you, like, look back and you're, like, going, the fuck was I doing?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
What is your relationship like with the first record? Now, like, what is it, like 10, 12 years, 13 years since it came out? Do you love those songs? Can you not stand them? Like, what's it like? Like, because, I mean, everybody's got a different relationship with a different album, don't they?
I think it's... I guess that's the thing. Like, it did feel like, keep coming back to video game analogies for some reason, but it was a bit like, I'm proud of that album. I remember talking to Casey from the band about before that record came out. I was like, you know what? Let's just like put this out on whatever label and just get started on the next one. And then, like, what was going to be the next one?
What an admission of defeat before you even said this.
It was kind of like, just like, oh, yeah, this record's done. Let's just, like, start on the next one. And then, like, those songs turned into the Sunshine EP, which ended up coming out first but was recorded after. You know, so my expectations were pretty low. So, and it's not like I wasn't like, this is the masterpiece or something. And I still don't. I'm proud of that record now. I don't look at it as much after, you know, when it was more present as like the thing to be compared against, then I was, you know, more critical of it, more trying to find ways to grow in, you know, both in like response to it and against it. And had a lot of like, you know, I just wanted to keep growing. I didn't want it to feel like plain Zelda after you beat the final boss, or, you know, and just having nothing to do and it's like the game was won or something. So I'm proud of it. I'm so grateful for everything that has happened as a result of that album for sure.
Yeah, big time. What is your Freebird? What is the one song that everybody shouts out at your show. That and I mean, like, you have to, like, remember, like, when you go and play these shows, that it, a lot of the time it will be like 95% like fans of the band, and then another 5% will be friends that are coming along because they've got them a ticket or something like that. So yeah. you have these people who maybe don't know all of the records, who are there and they're drunk and they go, play Freebird.
Yep.
what's your Freebird?
Well, I mean, we've been a generous, I think we've played White Winter Hymnal at every show, and it hasn't been some, like, a creep situation where, you know, people have had to be screaming for because it often goes unplayed. That hasn't been our approach. So
you should do it some night in a city that, like, has wronged you. Like, if you've ever like got like a parking ticket or whatever in a city that's wronged you, just don't play it. Fuck them.
Yeah, just don't play it. just stand it in silence for 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. This is John Cage, 3:14 yep. or whatever the number is. I can't remember. There was one thing that caught my eye. Now, I don't want to just completely do all the things that talk about at the beginning. But there was something that made me laugh, and maybe I shouldn't have laughed at it. Like, maybe it's like a little bit of gallows humor or something. But when I was sort of like doing a little bit of research before, and it said in your Wikipedia, when starting Fleet Foxes, Robin ran up considerable debt. And I was like, what? Like, what? And it was like, I have to ask about that. Like, I mean, like, were you, like, did you buy like a gold fountain what the fuck? How can you like get too much debt at the very, very, very beginning?
I mean, I don't know. That's the thing with Wikipedia. I feel like there'll be these little things that get exaggerated in a given article 10 years ago, yeah. and then they get slotted into the Wikipedia page, and they're just there as, you know, for time, you know, from now on. But they're not. I mean, I borrowed $7,000 from my parents to make that record.
But that's not that much in the grand scheme of how much it costs to put a band on the road and record a record.
Yeah, it was considerable in the sense that, and then I had a credit card with a $1,500 limit that I maxed out buying tape.
that's commitment to the cause. You could have just stuck a fucking like filter on it.
Yeah. I don't know if there were, no, we were, that was before all this modeling stuff was so good. But yeah, so I mean, $7,000 is considerable to a 20-year-old who works at a burrito place, maybe.
Yeah.
But it was to my parents. You know, they weren't going to be. There was like no interest, and they weren't even really. I mean, I did pay them back eventually, but they weren't hung up on.
Yeah, they weren't going to break your thumbs over it.
No. Yeah.
fair play to them.
And that's me, because I mean, I've at this point, you know, I've spent $7,000 in a day recording it. That now. You know, if you total up, you know, if it's an expensive day and you have a bunch of, you know, session musicians to pay, and you're in an expensive studio. And so I'm like, I don't do that all the time at all, but it is crazy that we got that record done for so cheap.
Is that a model that you feel is starting to change quite a lot? Like, if I was, maybe not Rick Rubin, but like if I was like a level below him with a real bougie acres and acres of space and outbuildings and places that you can go and stay and different rooms and stuff like that, I'd be kind of scared, because there's more money than ever in the music industry, but there's less money than ever in bands' pockets.
Yeah. You'd be scared about kind of maintaining the...
That bougie level of recording. Like, I feel like the equipment's getting better. And the money doesn't seem to be, you know, it's not the 90s. Like,
yeah. I mean, for me, like some of these things, you know, I mean, just having the luxury of making music for a living and to have the resources to kind of there's a little bit of like wish fulfillment in some of the sessions I've done, where it's like, yes, go to this studio. That's an experience I want to have. Go to the studio, work with these people. Mm. You know, I'm not like, I mean, the next thing I want to make, I want to record it in 2 days, just totally live, and just get super rehearsed and just do it in 2 days and just spend no money making it, but just focus on the performances and the expression and the, you know, what's being, no, you know, overdub wormholes or, you know.
Cigarettes After Sex do something like that, don't they? Like that band, they put a couple of mics in a room and then that's it. And then whatever's recorded is recorded.
Great. Amazing. What a concept.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can. Yeah, I mean, I've seen it happen with friends, and I've heard various different mixes of albums, and you just get. I mean, I spend more time with artists that I work with just tearing shit out than I do going, yeah. Do you know what this could do with a fucking theremin solo?
Yeah, I mean, both approaches are great. You know, I love really intense studio recordings, and I love like something that's just a live performance that's really expressive and emotional and all just captured in the mics, you know. And I love that I have the opportunity to kind of explore any of those options, you know.
So when the, like, I mean, it says like hiatus between 2012 and 2016. Was it a hiatus, or was it just like you were taking a break? Because a lot of bands will go 4 or 5 years without releasing an album.
Yeah,
and that's fine. Was it like ever like a, like this is happening? Or, cause I mean, the way it's kind of set out from what I was, when I was doing my research, it makes it look like the band took a hiatus because Josh, AKA Father John Misty, left the band. And I don't think that narrative is particularly true, is it?
No, I mean, like it was like that first record was super, that was an intense couple of years. And then I remember like in the meeting after finishing Helplessness Blues, I remember going to a meeting and we only had a 2-record deal. And so, with Sub Pop and with Bell Union, we had a 2-album deal. So there was, I remember the meeting with Sub Pop, I said, this is going to be the last one for a while. And that was in 2010, you know, when, before that record came out, but it was when it got finished being made. It was just intense. Like it was all really intense for me, being like young and under what felt like a lot of pressure. And so I think after that tour ended, you know, it wasn't so much that it was like because Josh quit or that, you know, the band, it was more like I already was like, I don't know, I need to do something. I don't feel like totally complete. You know, I've just been thinking about music since I'm 15. I've been laser focused on this one thing, and that has totally served me. And I'm really glad. And it's given me a lot, like personally, emotionally, you know. But I don't know how to, like, at that point, I was like, I don't know how to make food. I don't know how to, like, cook an egg. I don't know how to. I was just, like, not a real person.
Yeah.
You know, I was like a monk for music. And I think that was, you know, so that was more the state of mind I was in. It was. Like this has been an amazing, incredible experience, but I need to develop in other ways because I just don't feel like a person in the world, you know? And so that was what the hiatus was more about for me than kind of, it was just about personal development. And
what are your eggs? What are your eggs like now?
Great. Oh, yeah. Any way you want. Yeah.
Poached, sunny side up.
Yep.
I get that. There's a weird period in your 20s that, like, you know, no guy sits down and goes, well, I mean, actually, it sounds like you did, but like people with like sort of normal jobs that aren't like touring the world and doing fantastical things, generally pick up little bits and pieces as you go along, and then by this age now, you're like going, oh, I may flambé that, or do you know what I mean? It comes on naturally, but I guess you miss out when you live. It's almost like a rock and roll tour is almost like it's constructed chaos, because, like, you know, you have a specific time that you need to be on the bus and you need to be here and all the rest of it, but then everything else in between is a bit of a pinball.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So you don't really, you don't really sort of learn to even make beds, really.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot that is not expected of you on tour, and then a lot that is, but they're different. You're in survival mode the whole time, I feel like. And there's not, you're kind of like, the stage never felt like that safe of a place to me. I always felt like I was trying to prove myself to the audience, you know, so I just get super hung up on like any bad note or like
like, you know, off key singing, or, you know, I always felt like kind of like a gladiator in the ring with, you know, people giving you a thumbs up or a thumbs down, you know.
Yeah, and, but when you do a show so often though, like, surely it becomes like, I don't know, like, you can't be engaged in the show every single night of a 60-date tour or something like that. I mean, there's sometimes when I'm on the radio, like, I'm like thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner, and I can be actually talking about something and thinking about something else. That doesn't happen that often, like, but like, you're not always focused in.
Yeah, I've been there for sure.
It's probably more towards the end of the record or tour than probably the start. Are you guys bad for throwing side eyes and daggers across stage if somebody really fucks up? Are you like,
no,
like looking over? You're like, what the fuck are you doing?
No, everyone's great.
That's good. I played in a band. My friend who I played in a band with still apologizes to this day about, like, because, like, I mean, I, like, I'm a good bass player, but I'm good when I concentrate, but I'm really bad when I don't. And there's been numerous times where I wasn't concentrating exactly, and I might be sitting playing something else, or I might be in some way addled. And you just get the fucking death stare, and there's nothing worse. It's like your mom and dad's, like, stare combined, because you know you're in the middle of, like, playing in front of people, and it really fucks you up.
For sure.
The sort of, like, talking about, like, you know, sort of coming back down to reality and becoming a real person and stuff like that after the success that you had beforehand, was surfing part of that? Like, you know, was that like a passion you had that started then, or was it something that you've always done?
Yeah, for sure. I've been in and out of surfing. Like, I think, like, taking a hiatus and then coming back to music with Crack Up and this album Shore, you know, obviously I was, like, a little older. Now I'm like 34. So things have been more balanced just generally, and not so one or the other. Instead of, like, all music and then all self-development, like going back to school and surfing and running and reading a ton and, you know,
did you go back to school?
Yeah, I went back to, the hiatus was when I went back to school for 3 years.
What'd you do? What'd you study?
I was trying to finish an undergraduate degree, which, because I had just gone straight into music when I was out of high school. And I had every intention of finishing it. And then Joanna Newsom asked me to go on tour, which and she's impossible to say no to.
Yeah.
And just that one thing led to another. And then that just set things in motion for Crack Up and touring that for 2 years and then making this Shore record for 2 years. And
have you ever thought about invoicing Joanna Newsom for your fees for university?
Wow. They were pretty hefty. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll see you in court. So, like, I mean, like, I was getting at the surfing thing because, like, the name of the record, and I really like the idea of it. And I mean, you tell me the story about the new record for anybody who listens to the podcast and might know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had this personal experience where, yeah, I had almost drowned surfing, where, like, I snap my leash, the board goes to shore, I'm like 300 yards out to sea, you know, get caught in a rip current. It takes me a long time. That was kind of the most, like, in danger of dying I've ever felt. And that was like 2017 or something.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, like, looking for, you know, I wanted to make a record different from Crack Up that was, like, brighter and happier, but I didn't want it to be, like, corny in a certain way. And so I guess feeling like associating, like, that feeling of relief I felt with, like, how the music could feel, like, relieving rather than kind of, like, you know, ecstatic or something. Became like my, I was like, oh, that's a good North Star for the record, you know, and follow that. And that'll feel kind of like that feels good for right now. And then, you know, that was kind of that was obviously before everything happened in 2020, which kind of recontextualized what the record would be, but also kind of reinforced that a record like that would be useful in that time. You know, September 2020. So, which made me more inspired to finish it and get it out when we did digitally back in September. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like I love it. Like, and I mean, like I've you're one of those rare bands that like there's not an album that I wouldn't put on. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of, there's a shit ton of like bands that I like. And I'm trying to think of, I don't want to name anybody just in case I get them on the podcast. Cause then like, but there's been some artists that like, I really like some of their albums, and then some of them I'm just a bit like, whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, I feel a little bit of like, I love making music. I feel like a little bit, sometimes I feel like, okay, if I'm still going to be making music at 34, it's got to be like as good as it can possibly be. Mm. Like there's, I can't be like an aging musician that's putting out stuff that's subpar, because then what am I doing with my life? You know, just like holding on to something, you know? And so I think that that anxiety has been like a good mindset to stay in, like making records to some degree, just like it has to be it, you know. I can't in good conscience put something out that I don't feel proud of at this point.
Do you feel the need to like ever savagely like switch up the sound where you just like go completely the other way? Because I've noticed that there's a thing with rock bands, and I only noticed this quite recently, where they tend to like do a sort of dancey sort of style, like, you know, like a fucking crushing rock band will do like a disco beat album, or they'll do like a sort of funky style album, and they're almost uniformly shit. Like, I mean, I'm yet to hear any rock band cross back over to like, we're going to do a dance sort of commercial one. It's always crap. Anyway, have you ever thought about like severely ripping up the rule book and like going down a massive like techno funk rock route, or would you have to like do a different, would that have to be a completely different project?
I feel like you have to be so successful to be, for that to even be like an option, because you know it's gonna be like, you know, it'll just turn into a couple of songs in the set list of your arena tour, you know, that are, have this like, that are like this different curveball. I think now I definitely feel like it's time to do something, because Shore felt like, I did feel like it was like emotionally, like I was really happy with what was coming across, and just the overall arc of it. I was really proud of like how the songs flowed into one another. There was an element of like album making on that record that I felt like I really got it where I wanted it to be finally. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what you're describing of like, this is the disco album or the techno album. It was more like really trying to like bring everything that I've like tried to do together, and kind of more of like a culminating kind of record. And now it definitely feels like the time to kind of like think a little broader, and but I haven't been struck by the urge to make a techno album. I'd rather,
yeah.
It kind of comes down to the matter of expertise, you know. I think like I took Aphex Twin his whole career to make music that one, like that wonderfully inventive in itself, you know. And you can't presume in 2 years of research you're going to like end up making something authoritative in that field with, you know, just because you need like a story for what your next record is going to be.
That's true. Like, you don't want to end up sounding like a budget version of the genre that you're aping. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
And that's often the case, like with people who'd like completely wholesale change. I mean, just look at AC/DC.
Yeah.
Those fuckers have been doing the same thing. Iron Maiden. Like, do you know what I mean? Those guys just know how to completely ring it out. But listen, man, like, congrats on the new record. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to me, and thank you for playing that demo, which doesn't sound like you in the slightest.
Nice.
It's great, man. But thanks for coming on this week's Slacker podcast, Robin.
Thank you so much, man. It was a pleasure.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.